Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. The Morningstar Investment Conference for investment professionals will be held virtually this year on September 16th and 17th. We're offering the same research, analysis, and insight for investment professionals you get at the live event for a reduced price of $149. And the best part is you could join us from wherever you are. For more information or to register, visit go.morningstar.com/MIC. Again, that website is go.morningstar.com/MIC. In this week's podcast, we share two names we've removed from our list of high conviction picks in August. Christine Benz discusses the weakness in the U.S. dollar today. Christine Benz addresses retirement during a pandemic. And our analysts list three highly rated funds for your portfolio. Let's get started. We share two names we've removed from our list of high conviction picks in August.
In early August, Morningstar's equity analysts updated their list of high conviction picks. Two of the stocks cut from the list were Comcast and Dominion Energy. We've removed Comcast from our list of high conviction ideas because its share price is now near our fair value estimate. We continue to view the stock as a solid core holding that will create wealth for shareholders over time, thanks to the firm's wide moat core cable business and the moves it is making to build a strong media operation. At the current share price, though, we think there are better ideas for new investment. We removed Widemoat Dominion Energy from our high conviction list for the same reason. Its price approached our fair value estimate. Although annual dividend increases averaged 9% the past 5 years, management raised the dividend only 2.5% in the first quarter of 2020, and now plans to cut the dividend by 33% in the fourth quarter. The new annual dividend represents a payout ratio of approximately 65% based on our 2021 earnings estimate, and we believe it is now secure. We believe Dominion's dividend yield and earnings growth outlook could deliver high single-digit returns through this decade and beyond.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, "Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill," or visit morningstar.com/Alexa.
Now, Susan Jubinski and Christine Benz from Morningstar Inc. discuss the U.S. dollar.
Hi, I'm Susan Jubinski with Morningstar. The U.S. dollar has shown some weakness against foreign currencies during the past few months, after rallying quite strongly for the past decade. So what does the dollar's weakness mean for investors? Here today to discuss the topic is Christine Benz. Christine is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance.
Susan, thank you so much for having me.
So why do you think that we're seeing some weakness in the dollar today?
Well, it's a little bit of a head scratcher, and there are a lot of conjectures flying around. The reason it's a head scratcher is that typically in tumultuous times like what we're living through, we often see the dollar appreciate relative to other major foreign currencies. We've been seeing a little bit of the opposite pattern over the past few months. And one of the prevailing theories is that it may have something to do with some of the spending that has gone on, the deficit spending, and potential effects for inflation in the years ahead, that there are concerns that that could reduce the purchasing power of dollar-denominated assets. So that's one theory. Another theory is simply that the U.S. has been a little bit behind some other developed economies when it comes to getting this pandemic under control. So that could be putting some pressure on the dollar as well.
So let's talk a little bit about the implications of a falling dollar on investors. So there is an impact on U.S. businesses, correct?
There is. So U.S. multinationals, in particular those that sell a lot of their wares overseas, will tend to benefit when the dollar declines because foreign currencies are stronger. That means that foreign buyers are stronger and more inclined to buy U.S. products. So it's a positive for some of the big companies, whether Coke or McDonald's, companies that do sell their products overseas. On the flip side, it would be a negative for foreign companies that sell a lot of stuff in the U.S. because our dollars don't go as far toward purchasing some foreign goods. So it's a mixed bag. One thing to keep in mind, though, Susan, for people who own some of these big multinationals, many of them do employ hedging strategies, foreign currency hedging strategies, in an effort to reduce currency-related impacts on their bottom lines. So that's sort of a mitigating force here as well.
So Christine, what about investors who own securities that are in foreign denominated securities? What does a falling dollar mean for them?
Well, it means that you usually benefit. And so a way to think about it is if you are a foreign stock or bond investor and your security is denominated in that foreign currency, any return or loss that you earn can be decomposed into two parts. So on one part is the return or loss that the security itself experiences. And then the other part of your return would be any gain or loss in the value of the currency in which that security is denominated. So to use a simple example, let's say I own a Swiss pharmaceutical maker and my stock is denominated in Swiss francs. Well, if the Swiss franc appreciates over my holding period and the stock appreciates over my holding period, I win on both ends. On the other hand, if the Swiss franc declines over my holding period, but the stock appreciates, that could offset some of the appreciation in the stock. So the good news for foreign stock investors whose securities are denominated in foreign currencies, when the dollar depreciates, that means that foreign currencies appreciate. That is tends to be a beneficial trend for you as a foreign stock or bond investor. It's been a headwind for foreign stock and bond investors for the better part of the decade. So we're seeing a little bit of a reversal, but it's pretty short-lived at this point.
And what about, say you own a mutual fund that hedges its currency exposure? What does this mean for you?
Well, this means that the manager of the portfolio is trying to negate these foreign currency fluctuations as a portion of your return. So your return as an investor in a hedged product will pretty much reflect any gains in the security prices without the fluctuations in currency that we just talked about. So this is a way that some fund managers try to reduce volatility and try to make their portfolios more or less a pure reflection of how good they are at picking stocks or bonds.
So, Christine, currency hedging is more common among foreign bond fund managers than stock fund managers. Is that right?
That's right, Susan. So as a practical matter, many foreign stock funds are not hedged. Many foreign bond funds are hedged into the dollar. And the idea there is that owners of bond funds typically don't want a lot of extra volatility if they can avoid it. So that's one way that fixed income managers try to reduce the volatility in their portfolios. That said, there are still plenty of unhedged foreign bond products as well. They will tend to be more volatile and may have higher returns over time, depending on how successful the bond manager is at selecting currencies.
So taking all of this into consideration, how concerned should investors be about a falling dollar and its impact on their portfolio?
Well, I would say if you're a foreign stock investor and you own an unhedged foreign stock fund, this is going to be good news for you if this trend continues. It, as I said, it has been a headwind for a while now that the dollar has been appreciating relative to foreign currencies. It could be a positive. And so if you own a foreign stock fund, I think it's worth getting to know what its approach is to currency. Same goes for bond funds, where whether a fund hedges or not will tend to be a really impactful decision that that bond fund might make, that bond fund manager might make. So that will tend to be very clearly disclosed in the fund literature, its approach to hedging. Get to know that, get to understand that, because it will have a bigger impact on your returns.
Christine, thank you so much for your insights today on the falling dollar and what it means for us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski from Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Now, Christine Benz speaks with Maria Bruno of Vanguard about retiring during a pandemic.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar. Amid the pandemic, workers age 55 and above have experienced some of the highest rates of job loss, and some of them may be mulling an early retirement. Joining me to discuss some considerations to bear in mind in this situation is Maria Bruno. She's director of U.S. Wealth Planning Research for Vanguard, and she's also a certified financial planner. Maria, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Christine. Thanks for having me.
So let's get into considerations that people who might find themselves at this juncture, maybe they've been displaced from a job and they've really started to think about whether they should retire early. You say a first consideration should be kind of thinking through what retirement looks like. Let's talk about that.
No, that's a first start. For some individuals, they may have been planning for this, so they have their retirement planned out, what they want to do. But for others that may be in a situation where it's an early forced retirement, they're looking at this saying, well, I don't know what to do, right? They really haven't thought through this. So the first thing is really to think about, what does retirement mean to you? And I always say that if you're married or if you have a partner, make sure you sit down and talk through that, because oftentimes what we find is that not both parties in the relationship agree on the timing of that and the definition of retirement. So first, understand what your retirement goal is. From there, then you can go into the planning piece of it.
Okay, so let's discuss some of the financial planning dimensions. One of the huge ones is healthcare expenses, how you will cover them if you're outside of the confines of an employer-provided plan. How should people think through this?
Right. So the first step would be first look at what your expenses are going to be broadly, right? Look at discretionary versus non-discretionary expenses. Non-discretionary are those things like healthcare, utilities, insurance, like those types of things that day to day. And if you break that out, then you can get a better sense of what the expenses are. The big number is often healthcare, because if you are retiring pre-Medicare, you need to make sure that you understand what your options are with healthcare and then the associated costs with that. So if your employer offers some type of employer-sponsored retirement benefits, then that's a terrific source. Most likely you're going to incur some costs with that. If not, then you probably need to go out on the open market and the open exchange then and look at private insurance. So some of the research that we've done on looking at private insurance, it can be costly. For instance, for somebody who's 64 in a silver plan, that can be almost double what Medicare costs. So you just want to really understand what these costs look like. It's important to note, though, that this isn't necessarily an all-in new cost. Many of us have either been paying our health insurance during our working years, or our employer has been paying part of that. So I think you need to understand, what am I looking at in total healthcare costs? You know, what are my options? What am I going to cost? And then also, what is the incremental? Because I may have been paying for this through my employer plan during my working years. But understanding what the options are and the costs is critical. Also, once you reach age 65, it's just as important to understand the Medicare plan choices and the costs associated with that, and either supplemental or Part D plans as well.
So look forward, look at how your healthcare costs may change over time. Moving over to the financial plan, to the investment plan and the investment portfolio and its viability to see if you have enough, how would you suggest people approach that question? It seems like the gold standard would be get some advice, seek out a financial planner. But the old guidelines, like the 4% guideline for retirement portfolio withdrawals, has been getting a lot more scrutiny in terms of whether it's still viable, especially given how low bond yields are today. What does Vanguard think about that issue?
Right. That's the evergreen question. How much can I spend for my portfolio? So forced with the situation, it really makes sense to work with someone to look at your individual situation. We have spending rules of thumb. So you mentioned the 4% spending rule. We can look at these spending rules. And again, they're often predicated on looking at a couple levers. One is, what is your asset allocation? So for someone who's a balanced investor of, say, split between 50% stocks, 50% bonds in a diversified portfolio over a 30-year time horizon, if you run the numbers on it, about 4% is a reasonable starting point. The tough part with that is you need to really look at what the initial conditions look like. So we're really in a stress environment right now when you look at the markets in the economy, and the next couple of years can be very difficult. So you need to be really prudent and monitor that, especially over the next couple of years, because the early spending is so critical. So You want to take a look at this on an individualized basis, but I think, you know, you can look at these spending rules of thumb as a guideline, but really the key is, and we've done some research on this as well, the guideline is really to have flexibility around that. So in those down markets, you want to pare that back to give you a little bit more flexibility than later throughout retirement. The other thing I will add is if you are retiring on the early side, your retirement horizon may not be 30 years. It may actually be longer than that. So that, you know, if it's a 4% spending rule, for instance, or thereabouts, you really want to pare that back and maybe need to be closer to 3% and not 4%. But these spending rules of thumb really are meant for long-term sufficiency, but you really need to look at it on the closer level year to year just to understand what the impacts of the current market and economic conditions mean for you.
And people's sources of cash flow may change throughout retirement, which brings me to my next question about Social Security. People who are younger than their full retirement age do take a haircut for Social Security benefits. Do you have any guidance on how people should approach Social Security planning if they're early retirees in terms of understanding the trade-offs of claiming early versus potentially lower lifetime benefits?
Yes, that's a really good question because, you know, we all know if you look at the value of Social Security benefits, you know, the sage advice is defer, 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 right? Defer to age 70 if you can because you get the maximum lifetime benefits over over your life. And while that's great, you have many situations where retirees need that money to live off of. So, or they're looking at deferring Social Security and spending their portfolio assets and understanding that interplay there. If you do take benefits prior to your full retirement age, the benefits will be reduced. So you could be looking at a haircut of up to 30% on your benefits that are permanent if you take Social Security early. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. It's just understanding what that trade-off is. If you are an early retiree and you take benefits early and then you start working again, for instance, you might be subject to the earnings test. So your benefit actually may get pared back. So that's another thing to think through. I will say, you know, for low income earners, Social Security will likely be a greater income replacement, whereas high income earners, it's a smaller, you know, percentage of their income needs, and those individuals will be more reliant on their investment income to fill that gap. So there are some trade-offs there in terms of looking at Social Security claiming as well as drawing from your portfolio.
And you mentioned married couples, Maria, before, and I think it's important also to note that the Social Security planning should be as a couple, right? Because there are some implications for the decisions that you make that would have implications for your spouse.
Absolutely. So earnings history is important there as well as age. We do have information on Vanguard.com. We have a primer on Social Security claiming strategies, but you do have flexibility if you're a married couple, and there's also spousal benefits there. So, you know, as a spouse, you have the consideration of, you know, is my spousal benefit greater or is the payout on my work earnings history greater? So there is some homework there. And the dollars can really add up. So it's important to do the homework on that before you actually pull the trigger.
Okay, Maria, it's always great to get your insights. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Christine.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
And lastly, our analysts list three highly rated international funds for your portfolio.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar. Foreign stock funds can help investors round out their exposure to the global stock market. Today, we're taking a look at three highly rated international funds that are a little bit more risky than their more staid core fund counterparts.
Gold-rated Dodge & Cox International Stock is a great way to add non-U.S. stocks into one's portfolio for a couple of reasons. First, Dodge & Cox has a bevy of resources at its disposal. It has a very talented analyst team. Those analysts have global reach in their coverage responsibilities. And then there's an excellent investment committee that runs the fund. It's got 8 members. It's got a nice mix of veteran managers who have seen a lot of different markets and some rising stars at the firm. So I'm confident in its personnel going forward. Secondly, it's got a very appealing approach for the long term. It's contrarian and it's value leaning by nature. And in short periods, that can have some challenges. And that certainly was the case earlier this year when its European banks and its energy stocks really struggled. But over time, sticking to its guns has really rewarded investors. And that was even apparent in the second quarter as some of those European banks that got beat up in the first quarter really rallied. And then certainly over longer periods, the fund has a 19-year history, and even after some weaker years, it tends to rebound very strongly shortly thereafter. Finally, this is one of the cheapest actively managed options in its space. We know that fees are one of the best indicators of a fund's long-term success, and the fees are certainly an advantage here. For its part, Dodge & Cox International Stock is a no-load fund with an attractive expense ratio, and that's helped the fund build and maintain its edge over time.
Gold-rated Schwab Fundamental International Large Company ETF has a lot to offer. This inexpensive strategy uses a fundamental weighting approach to emphasize stocks trading at lower valuations, which can be an advantage when market valuations reach extremes. This fund tracks the Russell Raffi Developed XUS Large Company Index. It targets large and mid-cap stocks from overseas developed markets and weights its holdings based on sales, retained operating cash flow, and dividends plus buybacks. When the fund rebalances, it will increase its exposure to stocks that have become cheaper relative to these metrics and underweight those that have become more expensive, which instills a value tilt to its portfolio. This approach has some advantages. Steering away from the most expensive stocks can help performance if and when valuations mean revert. But there is a trade-off. Ignoring prices means the fund can overweight stocks with declining fundamentals, which can add to its risk. The fund's 0.25% expense ratio places it among the cheapest funds in Morningstar's foreign large value category and should provide a durable edge over the long run.
Oldmark International is an excellent supporting player for your foreign stock allocation, primarily because it's so different. Now, you wouldn't expect that by looking at it because it's a very volatile, very high conviction fund, and it can be very, very hard to hold for investors to hold. But that's exactly why it's a good diversifier, because it's not going to behave the way a core or more conservative foreign stock holding would be, and certainly not like the indexes. And that's because David Harrow, the longtime manager of this portfolio, is a very high conviction, very independent thinking, very experienced manager who's willing to take positions in individual stocks, in sectors, in regions that look very, very different from the benchmark and from his peers. And what guides him is not any sort of macro decision, but his fundamental research into individual businesses and understanding individual businesses and what their value is and what the difference between his estimate of their intrinsic value and the value that the market is placing upon that company. Now, there are going to be periods where it looks really, really bad, such as in the first quarter of 2020 during the COVID market crash. It lost 46% from January to March, but it came back very, very strong in the second quarter. In fact, it was better than nearly 98% of its peers and way better than its benchmark in the second quarter. So it's going to be a volatile ride, but it is going to provide diversification to your portfolio, and it is going to look different than anything in your portfolio.
That does it for this week's Investment Insights podcast for Morningstar. We hope you've enjoyed our program, and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions, or their use.
Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.